Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Transitions Tuesday here on Mind Talk. Every Tuesday is a day that we have an opportunity to learn about the various transitions in people's lives. And certainly today is no different. And I suspect that if it's not a transition you are already dealing with, it is certainly likely to be a transition you will deal with at some point in your future. I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Barry Jacobs, who is a clinical psychologist, family therapist, as well as an author. Dr. Jacobs specializes in helping individuals and families cope with serious and chronic mental illnesses. And his co-author, Dr. Julia Mayer, is a clinical psychologist, and she is in private practice in Pennsylvania. Dr. Mayer, Dr. Jacobs, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much, Pamela.
Thank you.
Now, the two of you have come together and written a book that we're really going to be going through today, and it is entitled Meditations for Caregivers.
Sometimes people think it should be Medications for Caregivers, but in fact it's Meditations for Caregivers.
Well, you know, and I get that, and there's so much that we could talk about in terms of medications and caregivers, but we're not going to do that. We're going to talk about Meditations for Caregivers, practical emotional and spiritual support for you and your family. And again, this was written by Dr. Barry Jacobs and Dr. Julia Mayer. Barry, you come to this topic not only professionally but personally as well. You had the experience of caring for your mom. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Actually, Julia and I both have personal experiences that help inform our writing. So my mother was living in South Florida for about 15 years with her husband, my stepfather. He developed Alzheimer's dementia, and Julie and I moved them up to live about a mile from us in our home in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. And my mother, during that time, was caring for her husband as he declined. But then, unfortunately, over the past 6 years, she herself has declined and has developed dementia, as well as very significant chronic pain, frequently falling. So I have been very involved in caring for her, hiring home health aides when necessary, providing a lot of hands-on care as well. And then Julia, who, by the way, is my wife, has been an enormous help in helping with my mother as well.
And Julia, from your perspective, talk about the experience of caregivers, from your personal experience.
The trip started in 2008, when my mother passed away suddenly post-op from a surgery that was successful, but then there were complications. So we were all very shocked. And she had been caring for my father, who had some multi-infarct dementia and diabetes and ambulatory problems, kidney disease. And so my siblings and I have two brothers and a sister, were all left to figure out care for him, and he lives about 3 hours from me. And we did get together, and my older brother, who lived closest to him, did the did most of the caregiving, but I went every other weekend to give him respite, my brother, relief, and took care of my dad. And that lasted about a year and a half until he did pass away. And then maybe 6 months after that, we realized, even maybe less than that, that there were some crises occurring with Barry's parents, and we had to move them up from Florida so that we could take care of them. So we've had a lot of years of caregiving between the two of us.
It certainly sounds like you've been immersed in it, certainly personally, as well as professionally. Let me ask you a question that frequently comes up in my experience from caregivers, which is, I've got X number of siblings, I've got 43 cousins, why am I the only one caring for fill in the blank, mom, dad, whomever. And there's often a lot of resentment that the only one, if you will, experiences, while many other parts of the family seem to kind of be missing in action. Is that common?
Unfortunately, it's much too common, Pamela. In both of our clinical practices, we work with a lot with caregivers around this issue. I often do group sessions with groups of adult siblings who are trying to find a way to work together. But as you say, the lion's share of the caregiving almost always falls on one child's shoulders. That child, by research, we know is tends to be the youngest daughter, if not the youngest daughter, then the oldest daughter in the family. And for the most part, the guys get away scot-free, which causes tremendous resentment between the sisters and brothers. When we work with siblings, we're often talking with them about how important it is for them to care together, not just for the sake of a parent, say, but for the sake of one another, because how they perform together, how much they really are considerate of one another, is going to impact their relationships pretty much forever after. Everybody remembers who was there in mom's hour of need, and everyone remembers who was too busy to really step up and provide care. So, when we tell siblings that they need to do this for one another, then they're more apt to take to really make some effort to be considerate and to share the care, knowing that the care is not going to fall equally on everyone's shoulders, but everybody needs to contribute in some form or fashion.
Now,
and in my family, the way that we worked it out, I have a brother in California. My older brother was the primary caregiver. I did every other weekend. I have a sister who went over when she could, but her children were young. And my brother in California would fly in every couple of months and relieve everybody. And we tried to divide up the tasks, and it was never fair, but at the very least it felt like everybody had a role, everyone could contribute. And at the end, when it was all said and done, our relationships probably have strengthened as a result of that.
I would think so. Now, Julie, I know that you do a lot of work with women's issues in particular. What is your sense of how it is that the daughter in the family, either the younger or the older daughter, tends to be the one most likely to take on the primary responsibility?
I think it has to do with the relationship with the parent over time, and often... let's assume it's a mother who needs care. She's closest to her older daughter or closest to her younger daughter, or the younger daughter didn't leave home, everyone else did, or it has to do with convenience and comfort. And also who the person has relied on over time. A lot of times it's a daughter who helps the parents go food shopping or run errands or take them to the doctor, and it evolves into that person being more and more of a caregiver. And sometimes because it evolves that way, that person doesn't share the tasks with other siblings or family members and feels like they need to handle everything, she needs to handle everything herself, even when the tasks start to pile up and it gets to be too much.
So for those folks who are listening now, and I know there's some, and they're saying to themselves, that's right, I do everything and I do it well and I do it better. What do you want them to think about?
Well, I have to say that I congratulate them, but that is not a stance that can necessarily last over years. People burn out.
Yeah, I agree with Julia that what we say to folks is caregiving is not a sprint. Caregiving is a marathon, and we know that in order to run a marathon from start to finish, there are things that people need to do, including pacing themselves and replenishing themselves. But one of the other things which is very important is to run with other people and run with people who are supporting you. That makes a difference in terms of carrying you over some of the rough stretches on the journey. And when there is one adult child who does all the care and doesn't want anyone else, we often say that they're hogging the glory, and that it's not fair to them, and it's also not fair to the other siblings who might want to play some role.
Julia, for the woman, if you will, in the family who feels compelled to do it all, but this is a reverse situation, feels compelled to do it all, but really has had a horrifying relationship or some variation of a horrifying relationship with the person who now requires caregiving. She really doesn't want to care for this person, or not only just the woman, the man as well. They don't want to care for this individual who has perhaps been abusive, perhaps neglectful. How do they think about caring for someone who, in their view, has likely not cared for them as well as they would have liked? And I'm talking about emotional caring, not necessarily financial or other ways of caring. Julia, I'd like for you to answer that, and then Barry, add your thoughts.
Such an important topic, and it's really what often brings people into our offices to get some help and support. I have worked with so many people who have struggled because they're good people and they want to do the right thing. And they are in the dilemma that you described of caring for someone who has not adequately provided for them for whatever reasons, alcoholism, mental illness, or just, you know, difficult events in their lives. But now the roles are reversed, and the adult child is taking care of the aging parent who was not there for them adequately. And I think that that is an extremely challenging task. And so a lot of times we'll recommend to people that they, you know, in our work with them, that they'll reflect on the old relationship that they had with this aging parent. But at the same time, think about what is it today in the here and now. In the here and now, you don't need them to be your parent anymore. You need to caregive them. So we want to help our clients or anyone reading our book to sort out what that relationship looks like in the present versus what it was in the past. And in the present, it doesn't have to be filled with those old dynamics, those disappointments, those longings, those hurts. It can be pretty much in the moment, I need to take Dad to a doctor's appointment, and then I need to make sure he eats lunch, and I need to give him his meds. It doesn't matter what happened in the past at this point, because when all is said and done, when Dad has passed away, I want that caregiver to be able to look back and say, I did the right thing. I was a good person. I feel good about my ability to caregive. I feel proud of myself. And to me, that's what's important.
Barry, any additional thoughts?
I think Julia said it very well. This is something that we really talk very directly to in our book, Meditations for Caregivers. There's a section called Moral Compass, where we really talk about how people can identify and draw upon the values that they have, the personal, spiritual, and moral values that might inform a choice to provide care for someone who may not have cared well for them. And lots of times we see caregivers who will say to us, you know, I'm doing God's work in this world, or they'll say, this is what a daughter should do. My mother was not the kind of mother she should have been, but I want to do this work, and that it makes me a better person. And besides which, by doing this work, I'm modeling for my own children how loving family members should behave with one another. Our book is made up of many stories of caregivers who struggle with issues like this, and we have stories of people who have approached caregiving in just this way.
The very beginning of your book, there are a couple of points that you make that are, from my perspective, certainly very powerful, and I trust from yours as well. You've said early on that you learned that compassion helps. Say more about that.
I think that it's very hard to do really difficult work. I mean, caregiving is often hard, unpleasant, sometimes boring work. It's very hard to put one's shoulder to the wheel and do that unless one has a sense of compassion for the suffering of the person we're caring for. If we don't maintain that compassion, then the person we're caring for just becomes another task to be checked off of some list, and then caregiving becomes a really onerous task that we have to do every day, and we'll develop a sense of dread about it. But if we maintain compassion for the person we're caring for, then we'll always have in the forefront of our mind that we are doing something which is has real value and worth, and that will help animate our caregiving as we go forward.
And I would think that is
even
Julia, yes.
To take that even a step further, I think compassion for the care receiver adds knowledge about how they need care. I think we become better caregivers when we understand that, for example, mom has some pride about wanting to take her own meds, but she's messing them up, and how do we help her to give up control over that so that she can take the proper meds and not get ill, but maintain her sense of pride. And I think if we have compassion, then we understand that that person needs certain kinds of support and they need to be spoken to in a certain way. And even beyond that, I think when you have compassion, you can add in some positives like joy and humor and things that make caregiving, even when it's very challenging, more of a pleasure for both people. And so the compassion goes a really long way because it, regardless of the past relationship, you're caring for someone who's a human being right now and who has all kinds of needs. And if you can recognize that, it makes it so much easier to be with them and to even possibly enjoy them.
You know, Julia, I'm hearing you say that, for example, mom might have pride around taking her medication herself, even though she is not taking it as she should. And it occurs to me that with compassion, someone could actually interpret it as pride, whereas without compassion, mom's just being stubborn, mean-spirited, and fill in the blanks, and then it gets to be even more of a struggle for both.
Exactly. That's an extremely good point. If you just react in that situation as a caregiver, then you're probably going to attribute those kinds of things to your care receiver, that she's giving me a hard time, she's stubborn. If you have a sort of non-reactive awareness and you can reflect on what's going on and you can remember to feel compassionate, you'll think about what that person is feeling and not make it a black and white picture. It's more like they're struggling with giving up control over their life. They've had control for decades. It's tough to give it up. So it makes it easier to navigate.
And it's scary to give it up. We're going to take a break in a few moments, but when we come back, I'd like for Barry, perhaps you to begin the conversation about Trudy and her hypercritical mother, Louise. It seemed like there was a real challenge there, and something brought Trudy into therapy. So we'd like to hear more about that. But right now, we're going to take a break. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and I'm having a conversation with Dr. Barry Jacobs and Dr. Julia Mayer, who are clinicians and co-authors of Meditations for Caregivers, which is an AARP publication. Folks, we'll be right back. Barry, tell us about Trudy and Mother Louise. What was going on between the two of them?
So Trudy was a woman who was in her middle age, who had been had spent really most of her lifetime trying to please her very critical, finicky mother. and unfortunately had never really won her mother's approval, and had really, as much as her mother Louise kind of kept her at arm's distance, Trudy tried all the harder to win her mother's love. And then, you know, this had gone on for a long time while Louise was healthy, but at the point at which Louise began to develop health problems, then Trudy saw this opportunity that through caregiving she could finally win her mother's love. And then unfortunately what happened for Trudy is that even as she worked all the harder on her mother's behalf, Louise was all the more rejecting. And this was just crushing for her. I mean, it was just kind of reinforced a lifetime of feeling rejected by the mother who she really felt should love her for being the good daughter that she was. For Trudy, this led her to becoming depressed, so much so that her husband recommended that she seek the services of a psychotherapist. And through psychotherapy, she learned that that this effort that she had been making for most of her life to win her mother's love was probably never gonna achieve the kind of success that she wanted, and that she had to accept her mother and her mother's limitations and really look for love elsewhere in her life, and that in the caregiving Trudy could feel good about the very important and good work that she was doing for her mother, but she shouldn't be doing it simply in the hopes that her mother would turn to her with a sense of love and approval that she had never given her before. So through caregiving, Trudy's relationship with her mother changed, and her relationship with herself changed. She learned that she had to depend on herself to validate for validation, and not continue to look outside herself, specifically to her mother, to feel good about herself as a person.
And so thus, Trudy, in fact, was really freed up, it sounds like, to live a more full life herself.
Absolutely, because, you know, what we find in this business of psychotherapy is that the patterns that we develop with our own parents in particular, that those patterns tend to get repeated in our other important relationships in life. And so with Trudy, she had spent many years looking to her mother for approval, but she also tended to look to her husband for approval, to her friends for approval, to her boss for approval. And through this experience with her mother, where she finally accepted that her mother was not going to change, that Trudy was then able to pat herself on the back, and then it led to her approaching her husband and her boss and her friends differently. And I think it was it really wound up being a growth experience for Trudy in terms of her own self-confidence and self-esteem.
It sounds like it would have been extraordinary growth for Trudy and for everyone with whom she was involved. You know, we've been talking about being compassionate towards the person who's requiring care, but you also talk about the need to be compassionate towards self. Julia, why is that important?
Oh, it's so important because caregiving is so difficult and challenging, and certainly for many people, it breeds guilt and shame and feelings of not being good enough and feeling terrible about having to set limits with the care receiver. And those are not feelings that, first of all, really make any sense in the situation, but secondly, they lead to the person feeling burned out and exhausted and very unhappy. And self-care is important in any circumstance, but definitely when you're caring for someone and doing a lot of hard work caregiving, you absolutely need to take care of yourself. And so one of the basic ways that we recommend that people take care of themselves is just accept that they're human. You have feelings, even anger, even hatred, and it's just normal to have those feelings. It's what you do with them that makes a difference, but all of those feelings are normal and acceptable, and we need to just be very understanding with ourselves, like we would be with a friend who is doing the caregiving, and understand that it is a burden and it's difficult and challenging, and it's very important that people try not to judge themselves, try to mitigate the guilt, and accept that, you know, no one's perfect, this never goes perfectly well, you do your best, you feel what you feel, and you make the most of it if possible.
There is a vignette in the Meditations for Caregivers where a gentleman is caring for his parent and ultimately is able to admit to his wife that he, on occasion, may in fact have thoughts of wishing his father dead. Not because he doesn't love his father, but for a whole range of other reasons. And you very sort of gently describe to the reader the way in which he was able to share that with his spouse, and in the sharing and the comfort from his spouse, relieve some of his own negative feelings towards himself. That thought is, how common is that thought when you've got a parent who is chronically ill and rapidly deteriorating?
I think it's an extremely common thought. And it doesn't really literally mean that this you're talking about Howard, that Howard wished his father would drop dead. It's more that he was burdened and that he was also anticipating that his father would ultimately pass. And part of caregiving that's so difficult is that you have some anticipatory grief. And so sometimes that grief shows itself as a wish. It isn't exactly really legitimately a wish. It's a kind of a thought. It's a wish. It's a fantasy. But it's also because the person knows that ultimately that is the end of the story. The person does die. And so it's really common for people to imagine what it would be like after that person is gone, or even to wish that it would happen. And in particular, when the caregiving is extremely challenging, I think it's a sign that the person needs relief, that they need support and care. And in the vignette about Howard, fortunately, he has a very caring wife who supports his feeling, anything that he's feeling. And it doesn't mean he doesn't love his dad. It just means he's human, he has feelings, he's burdened, and it's frightening to take care of someone who is heading toward the end of their life. It's just a stressful, frightening thing to deal with.
I would add that I think that there are people who have those thoughts at times about wanting a loved one to die simply because they're looking for some escape or some relief from the day-to-day burdens, and that they feel that they're not able to carry that burden much longer. So those are normal and expectable feelings, and unfortunately, many times people feel tremendous guilt about them. And so one of the first things we do is try to help them understand that many, many caregivers feel exactly the same way.
In the instance where the care receiver is expressing a wish to die, and the caregiver is doing everything he, she, they can do to forestall that, that's pretty challenging too, isn't it?
It is very challenging. So there are two scenarios. One is the scenario where the care receiver is just tired. They're tired of being ill, and they basically are expressing a wish to die and a wish to have a cessation of their suffering. And I've seen many caregivers in that instance kind of sadly and reluctantly accept that this is what a parent's wishes are, but want to defer to the parent's wishes. I've seen another situation where a care receiver may be depressed and may decide that they really don't want to go on any longer and are not taking any further care of themselves when in fact they could be healthier and they could live better if they would take some steps to better care for themselves. Say, for instance, take better care of their diabetes. And in those instances, I've seen caregivers be very angry because they're working very hard on behalf of a parent, and that parent is working against them. And then the caregiver is left in a position of saying, why am I making all these sacrifices when my parent just wants to undo the good that I'm trying to do? And in that second scenario, that caregiver and care receiver need to have a very honest and frank conversation about what the goals are here.
Speaking of anger, you give a couple of examples in the book where the care is not for the aging parent, but the care is perhaps for a young child or a sibling or someone who's younger who perhaps at their own hand found themselves in a situation where they ultimately required care. I'm thinking about the scenario where the daughter at 17, after being in a drunk driving accident, needed a great deal of care. Mother was furious with her, but also caring for her. How complicated and wrenching would that be on someone?
It's extremely difficult, and I think it comes down to that same issue of compassion, that this daughter made a terrible mistake. She was 17, and 17-year-olds sometimes do, and it has lasting effects for the rest of her life and the lives of all around her. And so as a mother of that child, there's anger, but there's also tremendous compassion. And in a lot of situations, what you see is the parent caregiver dedicate their lives to caring for that person and for trying to make to help them heal as much as they possibly can. And oftentimes, siblings and other family members don't understand that level of dedication. But it's the caregiver needs to be as dedicated as they need to be, and it's really about what they need to do for their loved one. I wouldn't judge it, even though plenty of people do.
There's one other component of this worth pointing out, and that is it's very common in families in where there's one chronically ill or injured child for the parents to focus most of their attention on their child, sometimes at the expense of the other children. And those other children often grow up with a mix of feelings. They grow up feeling that they have to take some responsibility and have loyalty to their sibling who is ill, but they also have a sense of deprivation that their needs weren't properly attended to. So I have a case now of a mother who now is in her 70s and been caring for her son with a chronic illness, and still caring for him, and he's in his 50s. And she's afraid that she's going to die soon because she's getting older, and she wants her two daughters to help to step up and care for their brother. Well, those two daughters can't do that because, in fact, as much as they love their brother, they also resent how much of the mother's attention he got over the years and how much they lacked. And so there's this very complicated family situation where everyone feels that they have a right to being cared for, but there's not enough care to go around. It's those sort of situations where trying to find out what's fair and equitable for everyone becomes really important for the good of those relationships going forward.
It certainly speaks to the complexity of being engaged in caregiving relationships. And again, it's not just one age range. Anyone listening could at any moment find themselves in the situation where they are looked to provide care for any range of reasons to any range of any age ranges for the people in their lives. Talk about, Barry, I'm going to ask you to talk about Lindsay and Brett. They marry.
Okay.
He's the drinker.
You have to remind me, maybe even tell me what page it is. Since we've changed all the names of the patients, so it's hard to know exactly who we're talking about unless you tell me the page number.
I don't have the book in front of me, but I do. I can tell you that Lindsay and Brett were married. She knew that he had a drinking problem, but she thought it would be okay. He, during the course of his drinking, had a critical accident. And now her dreams, their dreams for a life together doing all manner of things is different. It's gone. It's changed. It's over.
Yes, this is a very, very sad situation. I worked years ago in a physical medicine rehab hospital in a traumatic brain injury program when I saw this couple, and I actually saw many couples like them, where, people fall in love, and sometimes they accept a spouse's problems in the hopes of being able to change that person. And then when things go awry or where the dream is not fulfilled, the caregivers in those situations are really faced with not just the actual tasks at hand of caregiving, but the loss of the dream that she may have had. And so in Lindsay's case, I mean, she, in order to continue being Brett's wife and in order to make the commitment to caring for him, she had to very consciously say to herself, it's never going to be the way I had hoped it was going to be. It's going to be something different. I have tremendous sadness about that, but I'm going to have to go forward and do the best I can, because there is enough love here to carry us forward. It's just going to be a different life than what I had expected.
And again, in those kinds of situations, as you mentioned earlier, Julia, I would think there are any number of people who are saying, don't do this. This is his fault. Why are you bothering? Just stop. Go live your life and send him somewhere and don't even think about him anymore, because he created this problem for himself.
Well, I'm sure there are people who would actually do that and have. But for someone who wants to stay dedicated to their spouse or believes that it's for better or for worse, or, you know, who truly loves him, it isn't a choice to abandon him. It's just a matter of figuring out how to do the caregiving and maintain some kind of life plan. And you know, what Barry is saying is that the person has to really rethink their hopes and dreams and adjust them to the reality that they're faced with. And it can be hard to do, and it takes time. But there are people who do it, and I think they can get a lot of reward from sticking by that person and caring for them and building a life that looks very different from the one they imagine, but is still full of meaning and value.
One of the things that you made clear, you both made clear throughout Meditations for Caregivers, is that you can't really assume that you understand why another family member is or is not available for the caregiving. And very often in making assumptions about why that family member is perhaps absent, that can really further the breach or create a breach where perhaps there was none.
Yes, and I think, you know, these are situations that call for the most compassion, the most understanding that we can muster. I mean, it is because it's so important. We have so many needs, and there's such a desire to have everybody step up. And it's hard to understand when someone is reluctant to do it or claims to be unable to do it. And it causes hurt. It causes the feelings of abandonment when someone who we think should step up and help us doesn't do so. And then we have to make a decision. I mean, do we accept them? The reasons that they've given as for what they are. Do we simply say, I don't want to have anything to do with that person anymore? I've seen caregivers do both. Frankly, in my relationship with my brother, I've struggled with this. My brother was unable to do nearly as much as I had wanted him to do in caring for our mother. But it wasn't that he didn't do anything. He did some. So do I accept what I considered to be the little bit that he would provide and accept it gladly, or do I accept it begrudgingly and resent him? And if I resent him, then what is it going to do to my relationship with him? And so it becomes a choice at a certain point. Do I accept my brother for whatever his limitations are, financial, time limitations, or even, you know, limitations of his heart? And do I still love him as my brother?
And the other piece is that, you know, what does it do to you? I mean, if you decide that you're never going to have a relationship with your brother again, is that freeing for you? Does that add to your own sense of loss and perhaps burden?
I think it adds to your sense of loss and burden. I grew up in a family in which my father had brain cancer while I was a teenager. And I saw my mother and my father's mother, my grandmother, go through this, where they were very angry at one another because they disagreed with the care that my father should receive, and my grandmother thought my mother should be doing certain things, my mother thought my grandmother should be doing certain things. And then when my father finally died, my grandmother and mother then did not speak again for 17 years until the day that Julie and I were married. And that schism in my family really compounded the tragedy of my father's death. It just made things awful, because then whenever I had a conversation with my grandmother thereafter, it was very hard to be warm and loving toward her, knowing how much she had hurt my mother. And by the same token, my mother could never really bring up my grandmother's name again in my presence, because she was just so angry at her. So it just those sort of family schisms really just make caregiving and its aftermath much, much harder. And so in our work as psychologists and in our book, you know, we're really striving to find ways for people to maintain their relationships despite all the stresses and strains of caregiving.
We are going to take a break now, but when we come back, I'd like to turn our attention more specifically to the self-care that you both have said is so important for the caregiver. Folks, we'll be right back. There's a scenario in Meditations for Caregivers about Barry. I'm assuming we're not talking about Dr. Barry, but we might be. I don't know. But
we are, yes.
You are.
Yes, if it says his name at the top, yes. It's his story.
The waking up at 3 a.m. filled with anxiety about what his mother needs, what he has to do, what's on his list, and just, I mean, we know what anxiety can do to one's emotional and physical well-being. And you make a point of talking about ways to perhaps reduce one's anxiety about caregiving. Can you give us some examples of what one might do to reduce personal anxiety about caregiving?
Well, I think that because caregiving has so many serious aspects to it, you know, you're worrying about your loved one's health and safety pretty much 24/7, that a lot of caregivers complain about trouble sleeping, which is often because of anxiety and rumination. And then even when it's daytime, they're worrying all the time. And so there are quite a few things that people can do to try to reduce worry. You know, one of the overall things that we recommend is a kind of mindful attitude. So in particular, and often people complain they don't have time for this, but we still recommend taking about 10 minutes a day and just kind of grounding yourself, breathing, doing a little meditation or guided imagery, or it could be anything, listening to music, writing in a journal. And that's a very helpful one, because you can record what's going on and how you're feeling about it, and then you have something to look back on in the future to process what you've been through. Taking a walk, anything that gives you a little bit of time out. And I often say to people, you know, you can worry about every possibility, but it doesn't prevent it from happening, and it doesn't prepare you for when it does happen. You're going to be all upset when your mother falls down. Worrying about her falling 24/7 does not prevent that from happening, and it doesn't make it any better when it does happen. So I try to help people to get a little perspective. And part of being mindful is staying in the moment. So we have a lot of stories about in the book about how can you make the most of your time with your care receiver in the moment. No matter what their health problems are, no matter what you're struggling with, maybe you can have a few moments with some humor. Maybe you can do something fun together. If you can focus on staying in the moment, you can alleviate the anxiety a little bit. And keeping track of the big picture helps, too. Knowing that, you know, this is a time-limited process. It could be a lot of years. But ultimately, you know what the ending is, and you just don't know how that ending looks. But you do what you can in terms of safety, and then it's up to fate. You cannot control everything. And so in order to just maintain your own mental health, there's a kind of acceptance of the reality that you have to have.
For those who aren't quite sure how to approach this mindfulness, I mean, it is so much in our language nowadays, and there are still many people who are close to not really having a clue or a real sense as to what that actually looks like. So for Barry, waking up at 3 a.m. filled with anxiety, what would a mindfulness moment look like for him? What would he literally, physically do or not do?
So for this Barry, what I try to do when I still wake up at 3 in the morning worrying about my mother is I try to bring my thoughts back to the present moment, there's a very simple thing that people do called five senses. So what am I seeing at this very moment? What am I hearing? What am I tasting? What am I touching? To bring one's attention to bear on the present moment, and to not allow one's thoughts to focus on future worries, most of which are unrealistic anyway. And that is, doing that focusing on the present moment in that way, and also breathing in a very slow, steady fashion, has a tendency to elicit a sense of relaxation, and to help us get back to sleep. At least to help me get back to sleep. So that, the term mindfulness is you're right. It's very much in the culture. Most of us have activities that we already do that allow us to achieve the state of just being in the present in a relaxed state of mind. And that could be through reading. It could be through sitting quietly and praying. It could be having a cup of tea and just kind of reflecting on the birds outside the window. Anything that brings us our full attention to bear on the present. And gives us a sense of pleasure and peace and happiness. That's what we're aiming for with mindfulness.
I notice that neither one of you is saying anything about medication for the caregiver. Is that ever something appropriate to look at, particularly with a caregiver who's feeling particularly anxious or particularly depressed, such that it's interfering with their daily living activities?
The answer is yes. I mean, caregivers, like all folks, people get clinically depressed or become clinically anxious, and there are times when mindfulness in and of itself is not sufficient, and that even having one's caregiving burden relieved through respite is not sufficient, and people may need to speak with their primary care doctor to be evaluated. We have very good medicines in this day and age to help people with clinical depression and anxiety. What those medicines do is it doesn't change the caregiving situation, but it helps people sleep better. It helps them have more energy. It restores the appetite. And what I always tell folks is that it helps them better face the problems that they have with their best energies. And so medicine does have a place to play in this, and I think primary care docs are a good place to start in being evaluated for that.
Barry, you used the word respite, and for those who are new to the caregiving experience, they may not have a sense of what respite care looks like. And, nowadays, hospice care is also something that has sort of, I think, changed over time. Either Barry or Julia, can you begin with talking about what respite care actually is?
Well, I'll take a shot at it. Then Julia, you'll have a chance. Your respite care is basically just being able to step out of the role and get a breather. I mean, you know, most of us have 5-day-a-week jobs, and then have the weekend to kick back and restore ourselves. And most caregivers don't have that luxury because they're at this work 7 days a week, unless they've made some sort of provision to have somebody else step in for a few hours or even a day a week to allow them to do the things that they need to do to recharge their batteries. As Julia was saying in regards to her father earlier, her brother was doing a lot of the major care, and then Julia would go up every other weekend to spell her brother, and that was very important for her brother in order so that he could spend time with his wife, play golf, you know, do things that he needed to do, so that when he got back on full-time duty as a caregiver, he felt restored and could bring his best energies to that important work.
So it sounds like respite care should actually be something that is a important part of the care plan for the care receiver, is that the caregiver needs to have a plan for him or herself as well.
I mean, respite should be something that everybody has built into the caregiving plan. The caregiving plan, in order to be sustainable, needs to have rest and replenishment built in on a regular basis. Unfortunately, what happens in our clinical experiences is that, you know, people basically say, I'm going to care for my loved one, I'll do whatever it takes, and they just kind of go at it full throttle without taking into account that this is going to go on for a while. And that's why we come back again and again to the metaphor that caregiving is not a sprint. Caregiving is a marathon, and that you don't run a marathon going full throttle. You run a marathon taking it at a pace that's sustainable, taking the water bottles that people offer you at every water station, if need be, walking certain stretches, but doing what you need to do to keep yourself going so that you don't burn out. And so that everyone needs to have that perspective that this is a long race for the most part, and that we need to have a plan to sustain ourselves.
Julia, the concept of hospice care, it seems to me that it used to be that if you had a loved one who was going into hospice care, that you kind of knew that the end was coming pretty quickly. Now, people may have hospice care in the home, they may have it in a facility, they may go in and out of hospice care. Can you speak a little bit about what hospice care is and how it impacts caregivers?
I think it has absolutely changed for the better and given people a lot more options in terms of management of their loved one. A lot of times hospice care comes in when someone is in chronic pain, in intense pain, and hospice fortunately can help manage that pain, which as a caregiver, family member, you know, I wouldn't want to be responsible for figuring out exactly how much pain med to give my loved one, but that's where hospice can step in. And they do provide relief for the caregiver, and I think there are all sorts of ways in which it works now, so I think it may depend on location. It's not a topic I know everything about, but I do think that there are ways to make use of it so that the caregiver does get a kind of respite and also a little bit less burden with regard to the medications and helping their loved one remain comfortable, which is so important. It's very difficult to care for someone who is in horrible pain. It's just awful. So respite care is a big help along those lines.
Hospice is often misunderstood. Hospice doesn't mean we give up on somebody. Hospice means we're providing comfort to them and to their family at a time when life is drawing to a close, in order so that the caregiver and care receiver can spend some quality time together, so that their pain is relieved, some of the unpleasant caregiving tasks are being handled by other people. It allows a daughter to be a daughter at the end and not to have to be a nurse at the end, and that makes the end-of-life experience much more gratifying and bearable for many, many American families.
Thank you for that, Barry, because I think that's an important way for folks to think about hospice care, particularly as Julia has said, there are so many different kinds of iterations of it depending on where you live. Let me ask you about sleep. You spend a lot of time talking to the caregiver about the importance of sleep, and you give lots of specific recommendations. No caffeine after 3, which is when I would think that caregivers would typically go for the caffeine. No alcohol at night, which is when I would think that they would typically go for the alcohol if they were going to drink. Barry, what are your thoughts about this list of really clear-cut recommendations that you're making to caregivers?
So, I mean, I think in our culture, there's been a greater appreciation for the importance of sleep, and that sleep is important for every aspect of human functioning. That we, unless we're getting proper sleep, our mood is going to be poor, our concentration is going to be poor, we're going to be more apt to drink and eat to excess, and so. I think that for caregivers who are trying to run this sustainable race, the ability to sleep and sleep well matters enormously. And so the things that are on the list there are things that are known as sleep hygiene. And most of us, I go so far as to say, don't practice good sleep hygiene. We tend to go to sleep at different hours of the day and night and expect that we're just going to fall asleep instantaneously. And when that doesn't happen, we're kind of in a snit. I think that we need to understand that the body works a certain way. It works best when people go to bed at the same time every night and wake up the same time every morning. When we're not using substances like caffeine to stimulate ourselves, when we're not using alcohol to put ourselves to sleep, because when we introduce alcohol or caffeine, we're skewing the body's natural rhythms, the circadian rhythms that help us get to sleep. And so, good sleep practices, good sleep hygiene, matters a lot to caregivers in doing the work that they're doing.
One of the things that I noticed with some humor, but certainly I absolutely agree with you, is the recommendation that you not watch the news before going to bed, which, of course, is something that so many people almost automatically do. Julia, why is it important not to watch the news before going to bed?
Well, specifically because it tends to get people all emotionally charged. And that's the opposite of what you need to feel right before you're going to sleep. The list, it has 18 pointers, and we would never expect anyone to follow all of them. They're really recommendations in a very general sense to help people to improve their sleep hygiene. So getting some exercise during the day is one of them. That's so important. If you're sitting with the care receiver all day long, and then you go to bed, you haven't moved your body enough, and so your body's restless. So some of these recommendations are easy and don't take a lot of effort, and so that's why they're on the list. And some of them are more challenging. I mean, there are certainly people who have a drink of alcohol every night, and alcohol tends to interrupt the sleep cycle so that, you know, if you drink enough, you wake up 4 hours later, and when you wake up in the morning, you haven't had a good night's sleep. So there are some that, you know, I think if people are really serious about improving their sleep, they should consider doing. And others are just recommendations. Listen to relaxing music. Do some stretching. Those are just ways to relax the mind and body to prepare for rest.
Dr. Barry Jacobs and Dr. Julia Mayer, we are so grateful that the two of you were able to spend time with us here today on Mind Talk. And certainly not, we've been talking about the core content of the book, but there are so many resources that are also a part of the book. So I would actually encourage anyone to pick up a copy of Meditations for Caregivers in whatever format you choose, because we certainly know nowadays there are lots. Dr. Dr. Barry J. Jacobs and Dr. Julia L. Mayer, thank you again for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Is there a website you would like to refer people to?
So we have a Facebook page, which is the name of the book, AARP Meditations for Caregivers. And on that Facebook page, we have articles and blog posts and information about the book that may be helpful to readers.
Wonderful. Thank you both again very much. And thank you, folks, for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a licensed mental health or medical or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, you can always email me at Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That is mindtalk.org. Mind Talk programs are available to you on demand 24/7 at mindtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.